Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Compliance Guy. It is Tuesday, March 26th, 2024, and that means it's a hashtag Terry Tuesday episode. So I'm joined by my very good friend out in California, Terry Fletcher. How are you, my friend?
Good morning. I'm good.
Good. So Terry was off last week and she was gallivanting around the vineyards of Napa in California and having a good time while some of us were stuck sitting in our little office trying to figure out how we get through another week.
I was gallivanting. We went to 7 wineries in 3 days and
wow,
had a very nice, relaxing time with my daughter and her husband and my husband. And it was very nice. It was nice to just have a break. We had great weather, about 73 and sunny and
nice.
Yeah, it was really nice. Then came home to rain. I'm like, really? It's California. Stop raining.
Yeah. You know, we've had some interesting weather here in Georgia. You know, it's 80 degrees. The next day it's 42 degrees. Then it's 76 degrees. Then it's 34 degrees and it's rain and just crazy, crazy. Yesterday was absolutely gorgeous. Sunday was absolutely gorgeous here. And then Monday, the weather just turned sideways and it was cloudy and chilly and just, you know, one of those, you know, the spring freaky weather is upon us.
It definitely is.
Yeah. So while my good friend was getting an opportunity to visit wineries and enjoy the good juice that comes from, or the nectar that comes from the grapes out there, I did not get to enjoy my winery. I was bottling. We are a manufacturer. We're a producer of 13 different wines, everything from, you know, a blackberry or a peach fruit wine all the way through Cabernet Sauvignon and Pinot Noirs and Chardonnays and Sauvignon Blancs and all these different wines. And we still do things the old-fashioned way because I can't afford to modernize. So we hand bottled over 900 bottles of wine last Saturday. And let me just tell you, 900 bottles, that's 4 bottles at a time going into a hopper, then one at a time going into a corker, one at a time going into a capsule applicator, and then one at a time going into a double label. It is a labor-intensive process that takes about 4 hours with 4 people to bottle over 900 bottles. So I'm glad you enjoyed.
I enjoyed my spring, you know, my little spring vacation, which actually leads us into a good topic because we're talking about preventative medicine.
Preventative medicine, which starts with a good glass of red wine.
Yeah.
Brought to you by the Georgia Growers Association. No, I'm just kidding. All right. So we're going to talk about the annual wellness visit. And when I actually saw your email to me on Sunday, where you had said, hey, you know, for the hashtag Terry Tuesday episode, I want to talk about the annual visit and, you know, all the little nuances, the do's and don'ts and, you know, what have you. So kind of got me excited about it because and I got to be careful because I'm in the middle of a litigation right now that is surrounding the annual wellness visit, who can perform it, when it can be performed, what aspects can and cannot be performed via telehealth, all these kind of interesting things. And it was really interesting for me as I was doing my research you know, and as I was trying to write a rebuttal report to the plaintiff's expert in all of the things that I was able to find, but what was even more fascinating were the things that don't exist at, from a guidance standpoint. So let me go ahead and turn this over to you, and you pick where you want to start. And then as we normally do, if there's an area where you want me to fill in any gaps, I will be happy to do that.
I'll throw it back to you. Okay. So first I wanted to really get into just the three codes we're going to talk about and the three definitions. And I think people confuse what they are. And so let's just make sure we get them. So there's three Medicare coverages for what they call visits that have to do with annual wellness, possible physical exam. And, you know, you have to know the difference. So first one is called the initial preventative physical exam, and it's called an IPPE. That's the acronym. What that is we call that a welcome to Medicare visit. So within the first 12 months of a patient being eligible for Medicare, before they start their Part B coverage, within that 12 months, the patient pays nothing. If the provider accepts assignment, so you are a Medicare provider, and you're really going over the medical and social history. You're talking about, you know, the operations the patient's had, any allergies, injuries, current medications. It almost feels like what I hear a lot of my clients call established care visit. You know, diet, physical activities. They are going over current medications and supplements that you might be using too, but that you're not basically doing any kind of treatment or decision on it. You're just going over it and talking to them about it, talking about substance abuse, going over depression risk factors, if they have any. And then also really looking at the patient's functional ability and safety level. They now say you have to also look at cognitive assessment for patients. There is an exam component to this one. You have to look at height, weight, possible body mass index, blood pressure, visual acuity is a big one, and other factors they call deem appropriate based on what you just took on the medical and social history and current clinical standards. You can also talk about end-of-life planning. But basically, they call it a welcome to Medicare because they want the physician to explain to the patient, here's what you're eligible for. Here's now what's going to happen as a Medicare patient. And now we're here to take care of you. So that's the first one. And that code is G0402. It's reimbursed about $168. And again, it has to be done within the first 12 months of Medicare. Otherwise, it's over. The first time that the patient now has Medicare or Medicare Advantage. Otherwise, you can't bill it. So the second one is what they call now, and we call it an AVW, AWV, annual well visit. And it sounds very similar. I know people are like, okay, well, I don't know which one to bill. Well, annual well visit and then the follow-up annual subsequent annual well visit. The first one is eligible 11 months after that first IPPE. And it's again, once a lifetime, just as the IPPE was, where you're basically saying, okay, let's take a look. Let's develop and update a personal prevention plan for risk assessment for this patient. It's personal for this patient. And the patient pays nothing again, out of pocket. And then the second one is the G0438. G0439 is now subsequent. You can get those every 12 months, and you need to wait the 12 months. If you do it even 11 months and 29 days, you're out of luck. But the initial G0438 is worth about $166, and the G0439 is worth about $111. The reason I wanted to bring these up is I find, Sean, that a lot of primary care practices feel that it's not worth their time to do that. And they're missing to me on not just revenue, but relationship building with the patient. And just hear me out on this, because there's always a plan with Medicare about when they add these temporary codes, these G codes, these, you know, and I call them temporary because they're proprietary to Medicare and Medicare Advantage. If Medicare pays it, they determine, well, should we really come up with another code or is it just for us? But think about that new code that you and I have been talking about ad nauseum, the G2211, that talks about that complexity add-on for patients that, you know, you're dealing with serious chronic condition that now for a longevity purpose, you're going to get paid a little extra. Well, then coming back to this preventative medicine, if you decide you're not going to do that, how can you establish that relationship? Think about, you know, what you do from a defense perspective. And let's say that you've got a doctor that overbilled that G2211. And you and I both know we're going to see that because of all the bad advice about putting it on everything.
That's right.
So you go back and let's say you and I are working on this as somebody got audited and you're like, hey, wait, look at this, Terry. You know, we have a doctor that is so conscientious about his patients that or her patients that they not only do the welcome to Medicare visit, they're alerted to do that when their patients went from commercial to now Medicare, but they make sure that they also did the initial annual well visit. And every year that their patients get the subsequent annual well visit where they're updating those risk assessment plans, where they're updating, you know, all the things that they're looking at for the patient when it comes to certain screenings and any kind of counseling for those preventative services, and making sure that, you know, any kind of behavioral risks or any kind of psychosocial risks and activities of daily living issues that maybe the patient has a limitation on.
And you fall know, risks.
All those from those first annual wellness visit to then the subsequent, which is separate from problem-oriented visit. It's more about including that whole mental health condition and treatment options associated with those risks, but they've taken on the responsibility for that patient. So now if I'm going in and getting back to what we potentially could see, I'm positive actually, but potentially could see in TPE or even CERT audits on the complexity add-on later, you know, down the road. If I saw a physician that was actually embracing the annual well visits and understanding that care plan and that risk factor reduction with that patient, to me, that means that doctor is taking responsibility for the longitudinal care for that patient. So even though they don't have anything to do with each other from a policy perspective, from an auditing perspective, I think we could make an argument saying that, hey, this doctor not only is dealing with this patient who has chronic renal failure, and you know, this doctor is going to and adds on that code all the time and to every E&M and has to make sure the patient's got, you know, if there's dialysis or if, you know, they've got the right medication or, you know, dealing with hypertension, because that leads to kidney failure sometime, you know, with renal disease. And it's just a domino. But then they also embrace everything that goes with trying to keep them well on the perimeter, right, and on the peripheral. So, you know, it's kind of like to me when I have doctors that do moderate sedation and say, well, it's not worth it because it's only $12. You know, $168 for the IPPE and $166 for the lifetime for the initial annual well visit, and then $111 to do once a year. I don't think that's bad money for that. That's not, I mean, that reimbursement, and the patient doesn't have an out-of-pocket, and it's not just goodwill, but it explains to the patient you care about them. And am I wrong in my thought process thinking that if you start there, you've got an argument for what's coming? And I'll send it back to you.
Yeah, no. So listen, I think that was an outstanding analysis. And I think a lot of folks who are thinking about whether or not they should be providing the IPPE and or the AWV to their patients are going to hopefully look at it a little bit differently now. You know, first and foremost for me, when I think about these kind of services, I don't think about the revenue that it generates, right? I'm a compliance officer. I'm a regulatory person.
And so I'm for RCM, me, so I think compliance and I think money.
Right. So
that's
right.
Why we work well together.
Yeah. No, listen, and I don't want people thinking that I don't care about the revenue cycle. Of course I do. I opine on it all the time. I have clients that are always asking me questions, but first and foremost, I'm a regulatory person, right? I'm a policy, I'm a procedure type person. I am somebody who says we got to do things the right way. And in order to do things the right way, we have to understand what the right thing is or what the right way is. Right. So for me, to the last point that you made, I don't look at things from a dollars and cents standpoint. I don't look at how much revenue a provider is going to generate. I look at the overall ability to justify ongoing services for a beneficiary by what did they do for the patient out of the gate, right? If somebody avoids doing an IPPE upon somebody becoming Medicare eligible age, I just don't consider that to be good medicine, right?
And for me, I look at it as same thing, but also a loss of revenue. So I look at both.
Right. I look at it from an overall quality of care. I look at it from the standpoint that if you are the gatekeeper, for lack of a better term, as a primary care physician or provider to an individual, I'm looking at what are you doing from cradle to grave for this patient, right? So, you know, performance of an overall assessment of a patient upon turning Medicare eligible age, I think sets you up to not be reactive to a patient when they present with potential problems that could have been identified through a physical examination.
Right.
I look at the annual wellness visit as good medicine. I look at it as you're continuing to build upon a foundation that you started when the patient became eligible for Medicare benefits. Excuse me. Then I look at, you know, all of the things that are being assessed. Again, like you said, risk factors, fall, psychological, all of these different things that go into an annual wellness visit that allow a provider to have a holistic view of a patient, right, to understand everything from top to bottom, inside out for their patient. And that just leads to good ongoing quality of care. It controls.
That's why I brought up the ability to be able to support that complexity code in a backdoor way, if you will, right, you know, in an indirect way. If you're doing these, you know, the IPPE and the annual well visits, the initial and the subsequent, you've got that relationship established. Because one thing that I don't understand with the G2211 is how they allow it on new patient visits if you haven't established it. But let's say you didn't have a new patient visit yet. You're still in the process, but you'd have had an annual well. You've got an established relationship now. You know, you understand the dynamic of that patient. And I just think that we're always looking, and especially you and in your job and your position as a defense professional in healthcare. I mean, just think, if you couldn't find anything that showed that doctor was really supporting that G2211, but all of a sudden you found, you know, that this doctor, for good medicine, like you said, cared enough about the patients that they were doing the preventative and the risk factor reduction and looking at all the peripheral on that patient to understand their housing, their social determinants of health, there's, you know, psychosocial issues, their access to care, you know, just things like that. To me, that just, it speaks a lot to the physician, and you'd be in a better position when it comes to defending them if you saw that. And then I wanted to discuss who can do it. So,
well, yeah, I want to say one thing, and then let's get into who can do it, and then all these other things.
Okay.
You know, for me, you know, I actually turn down more cases than I actually take on. And I evaluate every single case that an attorney brings me. I evaluate every single case that a physician or healthcare provider brings to me who is wondering, what do I do? What's my next logical step? How do I defend myself? Is it defensible? You know, I look at all of these things. I do a thorough analysis of every single case that comes before me. And there are times where there are more times that I tell somebody, this is just unfortunately something that I can't assist with. And a lot of times it comes down to, I take a look at the entire episode of care. I have a lot of attorneys that will come to me and say, but Sean, they're only looking at these six encounters, and they're trying to, you know, prosecute somebody criminally on six encounters. And I look at them and I say, it's not just these six encounters. There has to be more that they looked at. They just happened to focus on these six.
Exactly. So
let's take, exactly, because these are the most egregious. These are the ones that they believe they can make an argument, a salient argument.
Yeah. Right. They're like, no, this is just what we think is happening. And based on your population, this is what we're taking back. No, exactly. That's right.
So for me, I say to, you know, the attorneys, listen, I've got to do a deeper dive. And I'll go back to the very, very first encounter. 99.999% of the time, if it is a criminal case or even a False Claims Act case, I go back to the very first encounter that the provider had with the patient so that I can see how thorough of an analysis they did. How thorough was their examination, their assessment of the patient? You know, what clinical laboratory tests did they order? What diagnostic imaging did they order if it was relevant? You know, did they make a referral to another specialist? Did, you know, what medical records did the patient bring with them, or did they request from other providers or health systems or hospitals to evaluate this patient to develop an effective plan of care?
Because it's funny you say that, because how many times do we hear because of the 2021 E&M rules where somebody says, well, I don't have to do a history and exam anymore. We're like, oh, people, shut up.
It's just insanity, right?
That's not what it says. You have to have a medically appropriate history and exam. And no, it doesn't have to be the bullets and count and all that nonsense we had before, past family social history, but medically appropriate. So what Sean is saying is that he's looking to make sure that you had a reason to see the patient to start.
And that you actually did something meaningful for the patient. I mean, you know, I could get into this whole, you know, backstory about, you know, this particular case on, you know, how I looked at the very first encounter and I thought to myself, how is this person even practicing medicine? But you know what? We'll save that for another day. Now, let's transition to who can actually perform the IPPE and who can perform the AWV.
Okay. And first I wanted to talk about the place of service, because that's a big deal. And then I'll get into that.
Absolutely.
So one thing that people have had a problem with, oh my gosh, there's been so much money given back on this one particular thing. And people, you need to look at your list. Don't assume anything. And you don't always want to look at things from coding and billing. You know, medical necessity is first. But when we look at the IPPE, for example, so the G0402, that is the Welcome to Medicare visit, the once in a lifetime. And that one does include a physical exam. Remember that. So it cannot be done through telehealth. That has to be done in person. And it even says that in every policy. So if it's not done in person, you cannot do that G0402 and get your 168. So the second one, the G0438 and the G0439, so the annual well visit initial and subsequent, those can be done via telehealth, either audio and video, or even they're on the temporary audio only list, which I don't like that, but whatever. But they don't require a physical. They require more history taking, their assessments, okay? And starting in 2024, Medicare includes the social determinant of health as risk assessment as part of the annual well visit. So just know that's now something they want you to assess following a standardized evidence-based, you know, tool, et cetera. But who can actually perform these services? Okay. So there's a lot of, I don't want to call it controversy, Sean, but a lot of maybe,
questions
about that. Okay. Because there's some MAC LCDs that say that it can be the clinical staff. And if that's true, then that would take it all the way down to medical assistants. There's some that say it has to be a mid-level provider, you know, or a QHP, as they call it, qualified healthcare professional, which would be MDDO or our nurse practitioners and PAs. And so who can actually provide these services? And then I'm going to give you a best practice, because there are some gray areas. So when you look at the clinical staff, if you look at the national policy, it actually does say under the supervision of a physician, that whoever the billing provider who's sending it in under their name, it can be done by clinical staff. But okay, so let's be realistic here.
And so, but when you say clinical staff, does that mean it can be performed incident two?
Yes.
Good.
Yes. So they don't call it incident two though. They call it under supervision. So they say it's not subject to incident two, but it is under the supervision, which is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of.
Because it's still incident two.
Well, what they don't want you to think you can do it for a new patient. That's what they don't want.
Because, but remember, incident two does not apply to new patients.
Right. And it actually technically doesn't apply to annual well visits because you're now establishing a care plan or at least a risk factor reduction. And incident two says the doctor's doing that. So that's where there's like this gray circle of, you know, confusion.
But it's still the clinical staff. I just want to get this point. The clinical staff.
I know.
Under a collaboration is what they actually say. If I'm remembering the exact words, under a collaboration, the medical staff, which would include PAs, NPs, CNSs, MAs,
RNs,
RDs, whatever it is, they can all engage in helping to assess this beneficiary, this patient, help to assist in the creation of the plan of care. They're not calling it incident two, but it is all done under direct supervision, which is basically incident two.
It has incident two properties. How about
That's right.
It's not considered incident two because incident two is so for you and I cut and dry, but it has, they're pulling out some things under incident two supervision that apply to annual well visits. But here I hope Sean agrees with me on this. We don't always, we never go into these things, telling each other, well, are you saying this? We just go, okay, let's do it.
We go for it.
So the initial annual well visit, I have a hard time with anybody that's not a QHP or a physician doing that.
If it's I agree 100%.
Yeah, even it's initial. Come on, you're the one that's making the assessment. And let's face it, even though AMA and Medicare might say, yes, you can do CMS, you can have clinical staff, which includes medical assistant. Medical assistants do not have medical decision-making powers in their certification.
No, but I think what they're saying is, and you correct me if you think I'm wrong, I think what they're saying is ancillary services, right? Like urinalysis or other things like that, you know, can be performed by the clinical staff. But they're really leaving the key portions to the qualified healthcare professional, the medical doctor, the doctor of osteopathy, to really drive, really, the majority of that encounter to be able to develop the plan of care, right?
They are. The problem is they don't put that specific in writing except what they put, what they expect to see within those, you know, those plans as far as, you know, one is a recommendation for primary, secondary or tertiary interventions or treatment options associated with risks or referrals to educational or counseling, you know, based on patient needs to have, you know, maybe tobacco cessation or discussions about advanced care planning and things like that. I don't think it's appropriate to have a medical assistant do that.
But now, let me ask you this question if I can, though. Can I ask you a quick question?
I'm okay with it because they're taking a plan that's already been, you know, done by the physician and then they're basically updating it. So subsequent to me is an update if there's anything and, you know, and they can be trained to know what the script should be to talk to the patient. It's the initial I have a hard time with.
Okay. So let me ask you a question if I can about the annual wellness visit. So because you're an auditor, you audit for Medicare, you audit for commercial insurance companies as well. But because we're talking about Medicare right now, the annual wellness visit, the G code that's specific to Medicare. As an auditor for Medicare, if you were to come across an encounter that was performed by a qualified healthcare professional, we're talking about the AWV. It was performed, portions of it were performed by the nurse practitioner or a PA.
Right.
Let's forget about some of the other staff because I just want to focus on non-physician practitioners. And you were able to determine that there was direct supervision, that, you know, a physician was on the premises, you know, they were immediately available, they were able to collaborate, all these different things. If you saw that an AWV or significant portions of the AWV were performed by the NP or the PA, would you deny that service? Would you say that the service was not eligible for remunerations because, you know, AWVs have their own payment category. And as such, you know, the direct supervision guidelines don't apply or incident two provisions don't apply. I mean, because it's such a gray area. I mean, how would you handle that as an auditor?
It's, you know, it's a gray area. If it's a mid-level provider, a QHP, they're eligible providers to perform these. Now, do I think they should bill it direct under their own license number? I do. But that's just an opinion. That's not a policy, you know,
direction. Right. It's not a policy. There's no policy that exists. But if you saw it performed by the QHP and billed under the MD, you wouldn't. As an auditor for Medicare,
I would not deny it. No, okay. Not as long as there was the evidence that the physician was in clinic, if they're billing it under the physician.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah. Very good. We are on the same page.
The only thing I question is if I saw the initial and the provider of record that signed off on it was an MA, I'd have a nervous breakdown.
Oh yeah. I think we all would.
Well, the rules say, and you're a rules guy, the rules say that clinical staff, and that's included, but to me, common sense says that's not appropriate.
Yeah.
So, and it's kind of like, you know, for the people that haven't actually read the incident two rules. And again, remember, these aren't under incident two. They're under a carve out of supervision that also applies to incident two. There's a difference.
Okay.
So you have to know the difference. It's not incident two. It's supervision they're talking about.
It is supervision, but yeah. at the end of the day, I mean, it really has all of the characteristics of incident.
It actually doesn't, Sean. It has 50% of it because you
can't get
that initiating, you know.
Can we say 51%?
Okay. 52%. It has a lot of the characteristics. It can't be called that.
Which is so crazy.
I know, it's so crazy. But the one thing that I just have a hard time with is when Medicare puts out these rules and they don't give clarity.
Yes.
And everyone says, well, technically, oh, you know how much I hate that. Technically, I can do it because here's a rule that says clinical staff. And then they're like, wait, I'm being looked at by a TPE audit for medical necessity because my medical assistant did the initial. And they said, well, your medical assistant is somebody you're using as a medical assistant. We don't even see a certification, or even if they have one, it expired, or where's their medical decision-making property? And how did they know the patient has a mental health issue? Right. You know, so there's all kinds of things where if they miss something in this risk factor reduction and it's not, you know, a QHP or a physician in the initial, again, the initial, it would just be a terrible thing to me to see that happen. So it's kind of like
full agreement with you.
Yeah. Common sense has to prevail even when you have these gray areas.
Let me ask you one last question if I can.
Sure.
And this is a sincere question. Would you consider incident two billing provisions to be simple and straightforward, or would you consider, as a Medicare auditor, would you consider incident two to be highly complex and very, very difficult for providers and their staff to understand, given all the nuances?
I have a two-part answer, if that's okay.
Yep.
I personally think they're very easy to understand. I think they're very straightforward, very easy. But the second part is, I think they're very difficult to incorporate into workflows, because I think you have a lot of multiple physician practices. You have doctors that, you know, are being asked to run to the hospital to see a patient, or have to, or can't necessarily be there, or don't understand the one role that is apparently only you and I know. They can't just be there in administrative capacity. So on their day off, you know, catching up on charts, if they're there, they can't be billed out under them.
But you're saying, and let me say this. You believe that they're simplistic and straightforward because you've had more than 30 years of experience working in this industry, right? This is not just something that any Joe Schmo can pick up and look at and be like, oh, that's simple, that's straightforward.
I think there's basics to it. I think
there are basics.
There's some basics to it that, you know, you did a podcast on this a couple of years ago, one of your daily doses. And I thought it was one of the best things I've ever heard, because it was just like, this is what it is, people. It was 20 minutes and it was great. I played it for all kinds of clients, and it you and I were 100% on the same page, which never happens. And so this is incident two. And I think that's what people miss, is that there is a straightforwardness about it. But again, the complexities or the challenges, let's say, of putting it into workflows in multiple physician practices or in practices that don't police the incident to compliance. We are the compliance guy. I think that's where you find leakage and holes, where now they're going to have to call you to figure out how they're going to protect themselves because they're in trouble.
Okay, cool. All right, great. So we are right now, we're 100% on the same page with everything that we've been talking about. Now let's go into because we talked about who could perform it. Let's talk about what portions can or cannot be performed via telehealth.
Well, on the annual well visit, there are no portions. Everything can be done telehealth. The IPPE has to be done in person. The things that are tough is when I see let me see what the code is. There's a code when you're dealing with the IPPE or the initial annual well, there's a screening EKG, and I see that billed, and then they say that it was actually, everything was done as as a telehealth. And I'm laughing because, okay, how can you do an EKG over the phone? You can't. And they're like, oh, well, the patient has don't even get me started. I'm like, no, they don't. I'm like, do they have an FDA approved? That's G0403 to G0405. These are the routine EKG screenings with the initial preventative physical exam. And I see sometimes people trying to bill for that with different screening or with different preventative codes. I'm like, you can't bill for that if you're not in person. So those kinds of things make me crazy. I know that a lot of, and you know, I'm the external consultant for AAFP, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and we have challenging conversations a lot because I love this organization. You know, there's over 500 physicians in their or 1,200 physicians in their organization, but they are always trying to find revenue opportunities, and they may be there, but it's always like, yeah, I put it on everything. I mean, it's kind of like somebody talking about ketchup.
I was going to say it's that Texas Pete commercial.
I know. I put that blank on everything. Gross. Ketchup does not go on that. You know, you're ruining it. And so when I hear that all the time, I'm just like, you have to understand that there too much of a good thing is too much. And just take a step back. They're giving us some opportunities for reimbursement, but why are you always looking at it about money? They're giving us opportunities that they're going to pay you to take care of your patients. Look at it in a different way and the money will come. And so sometimes just an answer to your question, I see a lot of these annual wells, these, you know, preventative services, these screening services, and I just see them all of a sudden, everyone's got a screening mental health condition. Everyone's got this. I'm like, stop.
That's right. That's right.
Stop. And the last thing I'm going to say on the annual well that I just wanted to revisit real quick is make sure, and I'm sure you see this there with frequency, people, you have to make sure you know the within 12 months of the patient enrolling in the Medicare program, within 11 months after they're now eligible for the initial annual well. And then once every 12 months for the subsequent, if you encroach on those timelines, on those frequency guidelines, you're going to get denials. Oh, and the other thing, here's one, Sean, I don't know if you know this. There was a practice that didn't bill the initial G0438. And they started billing the G0439, and the G0438 was never billed. And then they try to go back and bill it after they already billed a subsequent. And Medicare's like, nice try.
That's really. Not going to happen. Good luck with that one.
Yeah. If you bill the subsequent because you assume the patient just had one from another primary care doctor, you're making an assumption that's not good. That's so just be aware that you need to find out if it was billed or not, because they won't pay you after you've already billed the subsequent.
That's right. All right. What a great conversation. And, you know, as always, I learn a tremendous amount from you. You know, I tell people all the time, it doesn't matter how long you've been working in healthcare. Nobody can know everything. And it's so important to create and surround yourself with a circle of trusted resources. And I say this all the time because it's the truth. Terry Fletcher, first and foremost, is one of my most trusted resources. And it's okay that she and I don't always see eye to eye on every single topic, because that's what helps me in defense work that I do, to be able to unbiasedly see other people's views, to understand where I believe there may be an opportunity to make a salient point from a defense standpoint, to be able to say, listen, you have reasonable individuals who are well-respected, well-regarded professionals in this industry who have difference of opinions, different views of the same topic, not saying one is right, one is wrong, but it comes down to, are there logical explanations for why mistakes happen? And as you heard, you know, Terry, who's been doing this for a long time, like me, she's been doing it longer than me. You know, you heard Terry talk about, yes, Incident 2 services are straightforward because I've been doing it for more than 30 years, but incorporation of the Incident 2 guidelines operationally, not so easy. No. There's so many variables. There's so many things that convolute the process.
Well, it's like making a lasagna. I've been making lasagna for Christmas for 25 years, and I don't need a recipe because I know it by heart.
Yeah.
But you get somebody else and they're going, hey, how come you didn't put in this? How come you didn't put in that? Now you've got now you're talking about Incident 2. It's like, now you have to explain it. Now you have to, you know, there's always, well, what about? And same thing with a recipe. It's like, if you know it because you've done it forever, but then you've got to make the adjustment based on the circumstance.
Absolutely. All right. Such a great conversation as always.
Yeah.
I greatly appreciate Terry taking time out of her schedule, which is always busy with clients and with insurance companies that she's auditing for and doing education for. So with that said, that will bring us to the end of this Hashtag Terry Tuesday episode. As always, I want to thank Terry once again for being on the program and providing such invaluable insight. And I want to thank each and every single one of you who continuously tunes in, logs on, and hangs out with us just for a little while each week as we get an opportunity to explore our favorite topics of auditing, coding, compliance, and revenue cycle management. So I'll be back later this week. I actually think I'm going to do a daily dose. I've not done one of those in a while. Kind of contemplating it because it's a little bit of a controversial topic, but hey, I've never been one to shy away from controversy. So I'll be back later this week with another topic. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.